I call Senate Resources Committee to order. Today is Monday, February 20th, 2017, my husband's birthday. Let the record reflect that the time is 3:31 p.m. Committee members present, Senator Meyer, Senator Coghill, Senator Wilikowski, and myself, Senator Giesel. I expect Senator Hughes will be joining us shortly. Thanks to Ann and Matt who are helping us out today. Today the committee is going to take up one item, and that's the overview of the land status for the University of Alaska. So why would the Resources Committee be interested in this subject? Well, it is the issue of possession of lands through grants. Our state received land grants because of the Statehood Act to Alaska Native Regional Corporations through the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act and through the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act. Who has possession of the land and what they're allowed to do with it has significant implications. In these fiscally challenging times, it's important to constantly ask the questions about how our key government services function and how they're funded. I often hear from constituents that the university should simply sell their land and then they could be completely funded. The University of Alaska is the state's land-grant university. Like our state, the university needed land to leverage the parcel's value. Those dollars are being used to promote essential services and educational opportunities. But if that's not happening, we should know why. This committee has had well-rounded exposure to the University of Alaska. Senator Hughes, an education committee, has had President Johnson before that committee to talk about the university. And the finance committee heard an overview of the budget just last week. So today, I'm hoping we'll get further insight into the land grant opportunities that the university has. And I welcome President Johnson to the table. Welcome. And let's see, online is Kit Duke, who is the Director of Maintenance for the University of Alaska, and Andy Harrington, Associate General Counsel for the university as well. So welcome, President Johnson.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I appreciate this opportunity to shed some light on one reason why the university has historically relied on the legislature so heavily for funding, and that is our land grant deficit. And second, to educate you and to discuss with you, get your views of our approach going forward. We do see a pathway going forward, and we'd like to address that with you. And I should note that as questions arise, I can certainly respond to some of those, but we do have a couple of experts on the line. Kit Duke knows a great deal about our lands, where they are, the status of those lands, their utility, et cetera. And Andy Harrington is a member of our general counsel's office and has done extensive research into the history of our lack of land grant status. And so to the extent we need to weigh into some of those issues, they'll be available to respond to questions, too.
Great. Thank you. And welcome, Senator Hughes.
So if I may, I'm going to walk through four steps here. The first is to address the land grant deficit history, share with you our current thinking on a solution, and then review with you our existing holdings, and then provide you a little primer on the UA land trust balance. That would be the entity into which these lands would go. And I'd like to share with you, too, how we use that now, because I think it would foreshadow how we might be able to use increased proceeds from that going forward if we're successful. So first off, I think you've all seen this this map here. Only Delaware received a smaller land grant than the University of Alaska did. Hawaii got cash in lieu of a land grant. So, but there, I would note there are states who are just so small that you can't even write their name on a map. Rhode Island, Connecticut, Massachusetts. Those states all got grants larger than ours. Makes no sense from our standpoint. I'm looking at a schedule right now, which I believe you may have received, university land grants in acres. And of the state's land grant at statehood, we received 0.11% of that, and that is by far the smallest of all of the states. So we really didn't get our share then. We received approximately 110,000 acres due north of, well, close to 500,000 acres under the various federal acts. So our deficit is about 360,000 acres as we currently calculate it. A little bit of history here. The Morrill Act of 1862, you know, President Lincoln did a number of tremendous things for our country, one of which, of course, we're celebrating the 150th anniversary of, and that is the purchase of Alaska from Russia. But he also passed the Morrill Act, and it created land-grant universities all across the country, certainly for purposes of educating a workforce, but also to develop. That was one of the primary purposes of the Morrill Act, was to develop the frontier and to attract people out to the frontier, people who would be provided training by those institutions to then farm and work and build industry all across the country. In 1915, you may have heard the story when territorial delegate Wickersham was walking out of his office one day, and he tripped over a book, a volume that was holding his door open, and the story goes it opened up to the Morrill Act, and so in any case, he was able to get through Congress a statute to provide some land for what was then the Alaska Agricultural College and School of Mines. Fast forward a bit to 1929, the Sutherland Land Grant Statute, an additional 100,000 acres of land was granted to the territory for the exclusive use of the Alaska Agricultural College and School of Mines. In 1935, I just note, it became the University of Alaska. So fast forward to statehood. Early versions of the statehood bill set aside 10 million acres for the University of Alaska. The final Statehood Act was a whole lot different than that. It repealed the Wickersham Land Grant of 1915, removed Alaska's eligibility for Morrill Act lands. It certainly gave a substantial grant to the state, 103 million acres, but of course we got nothing. The expectation from Congress was that our land grant would be included in the state's land grant. So the state would just turn, pivot, grant us some land, and everybody would be good. One of the first acts of the first Alaska legislature in 1959 was to do just that, to do what Congress had intended by granting us a million acres. And that was vetoed by Governor Egan some 58 years ago this year. As you noted in your introductory remarks, Madam Chair, there are additional land bills that have been passed by Congress over the years. Full enactment or transfer of those lands is still, in many cases, to be finished. But in any case, our land grant, despite those various attempts, remains unresolved.
President Johnson, do you know why Governor Egan vetoed the 10 million acres? Or 1 million, pardon me.
Madam Chair, I don't know why. I would, Andy Harrington has delved into this history, and he might be able to respond to that. Andy, do you have a response to that?
Through the chair, Governor Egan was concerned about the same things, the anti-dedication clause, and since the state was very new and he had experience with the territorial government under which earmarked funds had been problematic. His veto was for some of the same policy reasons that underlay the anti-dedication clause. That's the best answer I can give, I think.
Thank you, Andy. And could you identify yourself for the record?
Sure. I'm sorry. I'm Andy Harrington, Associate General Counsel with the University of Alaska, and I'm in Fairbanks today.
Great. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
All right. I'll let you go ahead and proceed.
Thanks. We have a little bit of a typo here. Between 1997 and 2005, Senator Murkowski, Congressman Young, and again a different Senator Murkowski, all introduced several bills in an attempt to address the deficit, none successful. There was some significant progress made in 2000 when the state legislature authorized the university to select 260,000 acres of land. As you recall, and I think some of you were here at the time, the governor vetoed that. Legislature overrode that veto, and that went to the Supreme Court. And the question before the court there was whether a conveyance of land was or was not an appropriation for purposes of the level of override required. The court ruled it was not. But there was some unresolved question there about whether there was a dedication issue there. In 05, the university went to work selecting lands, working with DNR and others, and came back. We got House Bill 130 at that time, identifying specific lands. That went back to the Supreme Court, and that question that was not answered earlier was answered, and it was answered in a way adverse to the interests of the university. That land grant from the state was found to have violated the dedication clause of the Constitution, and so we started handing land back to DNR at that time. On this slide it summarizes that Supreme Court decision. There were further attempts. Governor Parnell attempted without success. In compliance with the court decision, we transferred those lands back to DNR. Is there a solution here? We believe there is. The deficit now is approximately 360,000 acres. A permanent land endowment would be very beneficial for the university, not Tuesday or Wednesday, but we believe in years to come it would be of great value, allowing us over time to moderate the reliance that we have on you and your colleagues for our revenues. Many heroes, Alaskan heroes, have attempted to remedy the deficit, but this the Constitution is pretty clear in the Supreme Court's mind. How do we deal with that? Of course, the feds have said we gave the land, and I think the feds are supportive in general. Of course, the state wants us to have more land. The question is who's going to pay for it? Whose land will it come from? If you keep reading the Constitution and the anti-dedication clause, continues. The sentence doesn't just end there. It says, except when required by the federal government for state participation in federal programs. As we look at this, we think, perhaps we should work on creating a federal program or framework or construct that would enable both federal contributions of land and state contributions of land in a manner compliant with the state's constitution. And of course, that state participation in such a program would be required in order to meet that constitutional requirement. We're in preliminary discussions with the Department of Natural Resources here, the third floor, and also with the congressional delegation on federal legislation to establish precisely that program.
So President Johnson, when we're talking about a federal program, mm-hmm. We participate in federal student loans. I mean, is that the kind of federal program you're talking about? What exactly is a federal program?
Madam Chair, I would ask Andy Harrington. He's been our point in working with outside counsel and our delegation on what that construct might look like, if you don't mind.
Mr. Harrington, did you hear the question?
Yes, I did, Madam Chair. Thank you for the question. You're correct in that this the federal student loan program is one of many different types of programs in which there's federal state cooperation. The concept that we're kind of marketing with the federal congressional delegation now is one that would create a new program that would be. That would draw on parallels from other programs, but would be separate from federal student loans and would be separate from other programs in the past, kind of modeled in some respects after some of these other federal land grants. But it would basically say that the federal program would set up the permanent land endowment to consist of a mix of state and federal lands, and that the, it's a little... I should address one ambiguity when it says that state participation would be required. It's a voluntary option on the part of the state. If the state were to say, we just don't want to put any lands into this program, then the state doesn't participate and the federal government has no obligation to hand over any lands either. But in a kind of a, it follows the voluntary state federal cooperative federalism model, that if the state were to say, we do want to participate in this, then the requirement would be that the state contribute some lands, that the Fed would then contribute some lands in sort of a matching program, not necessarily acre for acre, but some sort of match, and that the mix of lands would then constitute the UA permanent land endowment. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Hughes has a question.
Yes, thank you for that. And what I'm wondering is that would that take an act of Congress, and I mean that literally and as well as the pun, or could it be done through a regulatory framework to set up the program you were describing?
Is this for Mr. Harrington?
Either.
Okay.
Mr. Harrington. Thank you.
Thank you for the question through the chair. Yes, unfortunately, we do think this would take an act of Congress. We are cautiously optimistic that Congress in its current configuration might be receptive to this, and one might say that it should not take an act of Congress, but looking over the existing programs that Congress has set up, we don't think that this is going to, we do think this is something that Congress should consciously decide, yes, we want to set this up and offer the state the option, and the state should consciously decide, yes, we do want to participate in this. So, unfortunately, I'm afraid the answer is yes, this would require an act of Congress. Thank you.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you for Mr. Harrington. Also, if the act of Congress was passed and then the state set up its own program, would the legislature still be required to make the appropriation, or would the funds automatically transfer right to the university?
Senator Bukowski, through the chair, we think, if we're assessing this correctly, that the lands would be in the hands of the University of Alaska and in the hands of the regents of the University of Alaska, and they could develop income and revenues from those lands that would not require annual appropriation from the legislature. The legislature will still be controlling all the general funds to the university, and we don't think even in our wildest dreams that this land endowment would ever get to the point where it could completely replace all the general funds. So the university will still be subject to the discretion of the legislature as to the legislative appropriations, but the revenues from these lands would function as the legislature had intended it to function when it passed the original bill in 2000 and 2005, that those would be monies that the regents would have to invest, the regents would get the revenues from them, the regents would put those revenues into furthering the mission of the university without need for the legislature to reappropriate that particular subset of the funds year by year. Thank you.
Follow up, Senator Wilkowski.
Just so I'm hearing you clearly. So you sell some land for timber interest, for instance, and then the revenue that's generated would you're saying that would not go through the appropriation process, but rather that would go directly to the university absent the appropriation process? And if that's the case, are you aware of any dedicated funds that the state has that do that?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, I think that I can't pretend to have comprehensive knowledge of actual dedicated funds. There are only two, in the SEAC opinion, I should say, that the court said that there are three exceptions. One is the permanent fund. One is dedicated funds that existed at the time the Constitution was ratified by the voters of the state of Alaska, and the third was any dedications that are required when they are required by the federal government for state participation in federal programs. And I do not know how many how many situations there are that fit into one of those three exemptions, aside from, obviously, the permanent fund. So I'm afraid I'm not able to answer that question completely, but those are the three categories, I guess, for dedications that are allowable consistent with the Constitution.
Follow-up. Senator Wilkowski.
Just a point. I know there's Fish and Game Fund, which the legislature set up requires appropriation. There's a cigarette tax fund, which the legislature set up that requires further appropriation. There's a highway fund, which requires further legislative appropriation. The only one that has a direct transfer is the permanent fund, which the state is arguing in before the Supreme Court right now, in a case that I'm involved with, that it requires legislative appropriation. So depending how the Supreme Court rules in that case could have a pretty big impact on your ability to get this a direct transfer to the university.
Yes, I agree. Thank you.
Further questions for Mr. Harrington or President Johnson on this page? All right, I'll let you go on. Let's see, I think we're on slide 10.
Yes, thank you very much, Madam Chair. I think it'd be helpful to review for you our current land holdings and how those are utilized. We now have approximately 151,000 acres of land, most of that acquired under the 1929 Sutherland Act mentioned previously, and also land acquired from parties, purchase, et cetera, and then from local, state, or federal governments. An example would be a couple of our community campuses are on lands donated by those communities to further the interests of vocational and technical education in their communities. We have a land management office at the University of Alaska, not three, just one, and it's at the statewide level, and it's responsible for managing, developing, and acquiring, disposing all of the university's real property. In terms of benefits from our land, since 1987, we have generated over $200 million of revenue from our lands. That income is deposited into the university's Land Grant Endowment Trust Fund, a permanent endowment. That trust fund generates earnings, and those earnings are used for various educational purposes, research, particularly purposes related to natural resources, so fisheries, research, ocean sciences, biology, and agriculture. And perhaps the single most important, at least in my view, for the last 18-19 years has been the use of these funds to pay for the Alaska Scholars Program, the program that awards a $12,000 tuition scholarship to the top 10% of Alaska's high school graduates if they attend the University of Alaska. And since the formation of the Alaska Scholars Program, 3,882 Alaskans have graduated benefiting from this program. Now, I review this because it would be our intent that these lands would be deposited into this endowment, and then we would use those for these kinds of educational purposes as described.
A question, mm-hmm. President Johnson. Oh, I'm sorry. Are we still on slide 11? Are we just going to it?
We're just heading to slide 11, right?
Okay. So my question for you is NPS, National Park Service?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. Coming out of a commercial background, I first looked at that and thought, Net Promoter Score? No. So yes, National Park Service. So we have quite a few inholdings there. Yes, so I think about 30 properties, something along those lines around the state. So this slide just summarizes for you what we've got at this point. Of those 150-odd thousand acres, 12,000 or so are in educational. They have an educational purpose, so that our campuses are on those lands. That leaves 138 and change thousand acres for investment purposes, and you see a description here of the allocation, if you will, description of those lands. Now, you see down at the bottom right there, 96,000 or so acres remaining. We simply haven't had the opportunity at this point to really assess the commercial monetary value of a lot of those lands, but we have some of these other lands here in terms of timber development, those park holdings, current subdivisions, there are quite a few of those across the state, material sales, gravel, and the like, very valuable, of course, and then about 2,000 acres of potential oil and gas development. So that describes, in general terms, the land holdings we have now.
So a further question about the National Park Service in Holdings. You know, sometimes those can have access challenges. Where are those in Holdings, and what kind of access challenges do you have?
Madam Chair, I can't answer specifically where they are. I do know that we do have access challenges, serious access challenges, which of course constrains the monetary value of those inholdings. Kit Duke, who is on the call right now, has much more familiarity with specifically where those properties might be. So perhaps if Kit could respond.
Sure. Kit, can you hear us, and did you hear the question?
Yes, I did, Madam Chair. This is Kit Duke with the University of Alaska. Through the chair, they are in Wrangell St. Elias around the McCarthy area. There are some in Southeast. There are some in the Chugach. And there may be some others that don't come to mind right now. But almost, I would say, all of them have access challenges. That's why we call them in holdings. Because there is no way to get to those parcels other than maybe float down a river or fly. And we have been able to monetize a couple of parcels recently, one as a sale to the Park Service and one as a trade for land that was in the Seward area and accessible by road.
Thank you. Great. I'll let you go on. Let's see, slide 12.
Thank you. A bit of an eye chart here, but this describes the types of lands across the top. Here you see the general areas of location of the lands down the left-hand side here, so you get a sense of where our land holdings are across the state. The largest areas, as you can see, the Gulf area, let's see, White Mountain area up in the interior, Kenai Peninsula, Haines area, Fairbanks area.
Yes, Senator Meyer.
Yes, thank you. Madam Chair, President Johnson, when you say Gulf, is that Gulf of Alaska or what Gulf of?
Through the chair, yes, Senator Meyer.
Okay. I guess I need a map to kind of see where that's at, because that's. Looks like that's the bulk of your acreage.
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, if it would be the committee's desire, we can certainly provide some follow-up information and provide maps and so that you can see precisely where our land holdings are.
Madam Chair, yeah.
Yes, Senator Meyer.
I think that would be very helpful because I'm. I didn't take Alaska history or geography in college. I should have, but even White Mountain, I'm not sure. Is that northwest part of the state?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, I can see it from the dining room window and our deck. So it's east of Fairbanks.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Very good. Thank you, Madam Chair.
That'd be great. Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, while you're at it, I'd also be curious about the HB 130 lands that mm-hmm. you had selected. If you have I'm sure you have a list somewhere of those.
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, happy to include that as well.
Great.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Coghill.
On the Senate Bill 130 lands. It would be interesting to me to find out that you had to accept them, look at them, and then return them, and who bore the cost of all that.
Okay. Do my best to find that. Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Meyer.
If I may, since we're on a roll here with questions. The previous slide had 17,000 acres of potential timber development. Is that, I know timber harvest is a challenge in this state and all over. Is that something that you're aggressively trying to develop, or is that just potential in case someday we're able to harvest timber again?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, no, we have absolutely harvested timber. We have an active timber harvest program. Again, Kit Duke can go through the details there with you, but there's no question. I would hate to put an estimate on the recent revenue, the share of that that comes from timber, but it's substantial.
Okay.
Senator Meyer, would you like Kit to answer that question?
Yes, and while we're at it, the potential oil and gas development, I I guess I'd kind of like to know, is that on the North Slope or is that in the Cook Inlet, and where might that be?
Do you think Ms. Duke could answer those questions?
Yes, I believe she can.
All right. Kit, could you answer those last two questions from Senator Meyer?
Yes, Madam Chair. This is Kit Duke. The timber acreage, the 17,000 acres, we are working closely with the Division of Forestry in the Department of Natural Resources and also with the Mental Health Trust Land Office to do coordinated offerings of sales. We have completed two in the last 2 years, bringing in, I want to say, about $1 million. We did helicopter sale, two helicopter sales. So it is possible to be in the timber business again. Not right now are we at the scale that we were when we were doing Icy Bay timber harvesting, but the potential is there. We're trying to do it well. We're trying to coordinate with local communities and use local people in jobs, and it's been well received on the two sales that we have completed in the last two fiscal years. So the potential is in the tens of millions of dollars that the university could make from the land that we have currently identified. It would be much higher than that, maybe as much as 100 to 150 million if we get some additional lands that we have jointly identified with the state and the U.S. Forest Service as potential lands to come to the university if this program for additional land is successful. To address your question about the potential for oil and gas development, we wish it were on the North Slope, but we have identified in the land that we would ask for the potential to get revenue from known oil locations in the North Slope area, but where we receive value right now, where we get royalties, is on the Kenai and in the Cook Inlet.
Okay, very good, Madam Chair. And then also I noticed you have some land out of state, not too much. Is that somebody passed away and donated that land, or how do you get land out of state?
Through the chair, this is Kit. That is from donations, yes. We've not purchased any out-of-state holdings.
Okay. And Madam Chair,
follow-up, Senator Meyer?
Follow-up, yeah, thank you. How much and how often do you get land donated, either someone passing away or they just want a tax deduction?
I would say in the last 5 years, we've gotten probably one or two a year. They're usually not significant acreages. For instance, one that comes to mind is the Rasmussen house in Anchorage. It was two lots in Anchorage with the Rasmussen's home. That was donated to the university 2 years ago, I think, 3 years ago maybe.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Sure. Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. The when you own the subsurface rights for, let's say, oil and gas, does that mean you get the royalties instead of the state, and do you negotiate directly with the oil companies, or is that done by the state?
I think, Madam Chair, that would be a question for Kit.
Kit, did you hear Senator Wilikowski's question?
Yes, I did, Madam Chair. Senator Wilikowski, through the chair. Yes, when we own the subsurface, we receive the revenues from whatever is below the surface, whether it's minerals or gravel or oil and gas.
Follow-up, Senator Wilikowski.
Just transactionally, does that money go directly to the university, or is that something that's appropriated by the legislature?
Lead through the chair, that gets deposited into this trust, and it's not appropriated by the legislature. Correct.
All right. Slide 13.
Thank you. Here is a historical look at the balance of that University of Alaska land trust into which the proceeds of land development and sales is deposited. And you can see how this has grown over the years and the shares of it in terms of real properties, in terms of cash and investments, and accounts receivable. You can certainly see the market crash here because the lion's share of these of this trust is in cash and investments. And so, like other trusts and other endowments, that took quite a hit at that point, and ours is similar to that. And again, I'd emphasize that it is the earnings from this trust that we use for university purposes. This last slide here, slide 14, shows you the five-year balances here of the trust, and of the last year here, FY16, $138 ballpark million dollars. So a description of what's there now. Hopefully, if our solution works, we'll see these numbers to the north of this, and consequently, these funds would generate more that could be used for educational purposes, and then, of course, over the long term, to moderate some of the demand, the reliance we have on the legislature for our funds. So we're trying to diversify our fund sources, trying to contribute to responsible development of our state. And with that, we appreciate the time here today. We are, as we've described our solution here, we're not asking at this time for action by this body, but simply here to inform you of our thinking. And then as we proceed, we would be happy to keep you up to speed. And then if we're successful back east, then to take the second step and come to you for your support.
Thank you for your presentation, President Johnson. Senator Coghill.
Thank you. And we'll watch with interest how you approach federal government and what kind of a program. But it sounds like at this point you would still have the expectation that the federal program would allow state lands to be conveyed over under some authority that the federal government. Do you anticipate that they would want to add some federal land to that?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, that is certainly our hope, that we get some federal land in there as well.
Yes, Senator Wilikowski.
And it is the way you get around the dedicated funds clause now because the land was donated or designated prior to the enactment of the Alaska Constitution?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I don't know exactly whether that's the I wouldn't use the word get around, but
able I think, to legally do it, I guess.
Yeah. I think as much as it's a legal question, I'd ask Andy Harrington to respond to that, please.
Mr. Harrington, did you hear Senator Wilikowski's question?
Yes, I did. And through the chair, thank you for the question. I guess I would say that in the SEAC opinion, the Alaska Supreme Court noted that what the Alaska legislature tried to accomplish in 2000 and 2005 was analogous to how the federal land grants had worked during territorial days when the money from those federal land grants was used for the university. And so I think that the Alaska Supreme Court kind of recognized that the arrangement of the former land grants was one that had been in place since territorial days. They did not explicitly state that that system was met with the exception for funds that were already in place at the time the Constitution was ratified, but I think implicitly it's a fair reading of the opinion. That was not a question that was before them. They were just trying to decide whether this new 2000-2005 legislation was compliant with the anti-dedication clause and said it was not. But I think it's a fair reading to say that the pre-statehood federal land grants did not violate the current Constitution, and most logically, that's because they were in place as the time of statehood.
Follow-up, Senator Wilkowski.
Who decides how the funds are dispersed from the UA Land Trust balance?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, the Board of Regents makes that decision upon a recommendation from me.
Senator Coghill.
So would it be the expectation that you would go to those that were already outlined in bulk by the 2005 legislation to include lands from Alaska?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, I think we certainly would look there to see what lands were part of that, and then to the extent we've learned more since then about the value of lands, whether there are oil and gas opportunities, perhaps where there are sustainable energy opportunities. As you know well, in your district is the Alaska Center for Energy and Power at University of Alaska Fairbanks, and they've done a really impressive census of alternative energy resources across the state. And so I think with that additional information of how one might monetize the value of land, there may be some additional lands that we look at too. So multiple sources, but we would certainly start with what's already been passed.
Follow-up, Senator Coghill.
Sure. The only reason I bring that up is because those were kind of compromise selections that went through a pretty rigorous process, and so no sense in reinventing that. So, and then the other thing is, I'm also a little conflicted because I think it's the university has some of their acreage outside of my hometown. They have a pretty good chunk of 12,000 acres, and my guess is that's over there on the other side of the town where there's ag land, potential gas land, and some transportation corridors. So, you know, between you, the state, and Doyon, I think we'd like to see something happen out there. I mean, so I'd like to encourage you.
Thank you, sir.
Further questions for President Johnson or his team that's online? All right, seeing none, thank you very much. Very informative.
Well, really appreciate the opportunity to go through this with you, and appreciate the support from Kit Duke and Andy Harrington. And thank you. We look forward to the opportunity to come back with some good news and some potential here for your own participation in our future. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you. All right. That concludes our meeting for today. Our next hearing will be on Wednesday, February 22nd. At that time, we'll have an overview from the Office of Project Management and Permitting, otherwise known as OPMP, and more specifically, that office's efforts to address the cost of wetlands mitigation. So at this time, we'll stand adjourned. The time is 4:13 p.m.